This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, tight budgets mean justice delayed. Today is the first day of a new month that will bring substantial changes to the way the state runs its criminal justice system. By the time all of the layoffs, leaves, and unfilled positions are accounted for, nearly 70 public defenders may be eliminated from the statewide system, at least for now. The cuts come from a combination of reductions in state funding and an ongoing deficit at the State Board of Public Defense. That means delayed trials for the defendants who are using public attorneys and delayed justice for crime victims who await their day in court. It also means a punishing caseload for the public defenders that remain. One attorney who retired as a public defender told the Pioneer Press recently, "I think the public defenders are at a point where they can't ethically represent the number of people they're being assigned to." We'll talk about that with our guest this morning. We'll also talk about how these cuts will ripple through the rest of the court system that many judges argue is already overtaxed. And we'll talk about whether the cuts here and in the public defender systems in many cities and counties throughout the country tell us something about how public attitudes toward the criminal justice system are changing. To our guest this hour, Lisa Kloster is a public defender for Dakota County, and she joins me in the studio today. And Lisa, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
John Stewart's with us as well. He's a state public defender, and he's with me in the studio. And John, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I should also mention that Bob Collins, who writes our News Cut blog, spent the work day yesterday with Lisa to get a feel for the demands of the job. And you can find what he wrote about the experience on our News Cut blog on the main page of MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Lisa, I want to talk to you about how the caseloads are going to be affected by these cuts in just a moment. But tell me what a typical day is like now.
The typical day, I think, is having 7, 8, 9 clients on one calendar and sometimes several courtrooms that you're going back and forth to and trying to balance the caseloads, the papers, the prosecutors. You also have dealing with multiple prosecutors usually.
So simultaneously, you might be having hearings in one courtroom, and then there's a hearing in another courtroom, and you're going back and forth?
Correct.
How are you making sure that you're representing those clients sufficiently when you're, you know, when you're under pressure like that?
That's a good question. Usually you walk away feeling like you're not, because you're telling people, wait a minute, I'll be right back. Let me go check in with this judge, make sure he knows where I am so no one's mad in that courtroom. Coming back to the other courtroom, trying to talk with the client. Wait a minute, I need to talk to the prosecutor first. I find myself saying, just wait just a second, and trying to gather a lot of information so that I can have everything, sit down with the client and have a conversation. But in a calendar for us is either a morning or an afternoon. So you're usually talking about 9 to noon, or like a 1 to 4:30.
So how many cases might you be juggling at a time? I mean, how many cases are in play at the moment for you?
For instance, yesterday afternoon, it was an omnibus calendar, which is like a pretrial. And I was lucky enough that the clerks actually scheduled us all in one courtroom. They divided up the calendars based upon the public defenders. And so that made my life easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I had four prosecutors that I was dealing with in the one courtroom with 7 clients.
And right now, overall, how many cases are on your caseload? Overall, total.
Right now, I've got 65 open files. And that is a snapshot. When I look at my caseload, I try not to because it kind of stresses me out. But when I take a snapshot of my caseload, it's in one particular day at one particular moment. I may go to court and actually finish a case and have it closed out, but then the day after that, I'm down in the jail, and anybody that's new and assigned to me on that jail calendar, I take with me and open up new files so I could get 10, 15, 20 more on the following day as well.
So might you be juggling somewhere at any given time between, what, 70 and 100 cases?
Generally, yeah, 70 to 100. When I get up to 100, I've kind of lost control
over
things.
You're feeling like you've maxed out, but does that happen?
It has happened, it depends also on what kind of cases they are and whether or not the people are in custody. The general reaction to having them get the caseloads getting higher and higher is to try to take the people that aren't in custody and kind of push them as far out as possible to give yourself more time to get them prepped. The more cases you have, the more time you're in court, the less time you have right. to read to the files and prepare it.
To know exactly. what the case is all about. John, how exactly. unusual is this in the lives of the average public defender across Minnesota?
I think this is typical, and I might add that Lisa's working part-time, too. I mean, imagine if she had a full-time job.
Well, how many cases would she have if she had a full-time job?
Well, she'd have more. I think
well,
Lisa's,
double, or?
I think Lisa's three-quarter time now, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm at 75% okay. time.
Right, so add a third to everything that she's talking about.
So
it's fairly typical.
And as doing what you do with the state public defense board here, what's the implication of this, of having public defenders do this day after day and juggle these kinds of cases and these numbers of cases?
I think you have to believe in what you're doing. It's not something that a person would do just to have a job. You have to care about providing good services to people. And secondly, you have to be able to manage your time very well. You have to be well organized. You have to be pretty clear thinking and able to think on your feet, because mm-hmm. you don't get a lot of sit-down time in these jobs. Very often you come in the office at 7:45 and you pick up 10 files, and then you're off and running until lunchtime comes around 5:01, and then at 1:30 you're off again with another 10 files.
This does not really give these lawyers, though, time for any kind of creative legal strategies, or I mean, this sounds so much like not going through the motions, but always trying to catch up and doing the minimum that you have to do to stay on top of it. Is that fair?
Well, I think people do a good job, and part of it is that your mind is working during the night. So in the morning when you're taking a shower, you're getting ideas.
Is that right?
That's true.
You're solving, or you're attending to some of your cases in the middle of the night?
I do that a lot, and actually last night I was tending to the cases that I had on the calendar already from the morning before. So, yeah, I think it is a continual process when people say, you know, you have a part-time job. I think basically we do think about our clients and our cases 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And you need to do that as part of preparation and knowing what you're doing, and it's there somewhere in the back of your mind so that when you have your you know, 7 clients and 5 seconds to talk to the prosecutor, you open up the file and you remember some of those arguments you're going to make, and you have to get it out. I mean, this is like jumping out of an airplane. This is high adrenaline activity. You're in there and you're thinking on your feet and you're trying to remember everything. I mean, I think there's a pretty good talent level among the public defenders and the people that choose to do it. I think you have to accept you're not going to always be prepared. You're not going to have a script for everything you do. You need to be able to fly by the seat of your pants.
I think it's like the TV show MASH, if you remember that. You know, the doctors care about the people. They're operating all the time. And while they're operating, they can hear the helicopters coming in with more wounded people that need help. It's just always something coming in, and you're always working, and you're thinking on your feet.
So, John, given that, and given the fact that there are more cuts to come, as I said, do you think it's going to end up being around 70 public defenders out of the system when it's all said and done?
It's going to be 72 public defenders. And of those, 19 of them are positions that were eliminated in a hiring freeze that started around Christmas.
Okay.
And then this summer we had to eliminate 53 more positions, of which 30 of them were people that took a leave or early retirement, and then 23 people actually laid off.
But these are people out of the system, no longer handling cases.
Right, absolutely. 72 people will be missing from the system by the end of the month.
What happened? How did we get to this point?
It's a combination of three things. First of all, because of the economy, people aren't retiring the way they used to. We used to have 30 people a year retire. And as the people from the top of the pay scale retire, you're recruiting new people that are coming in on step one. This year, instead of 30 people, in the first 5 months of the year, we had 4 people retire. So that's one thing. Secondly, the Department of Finance told the state agencies to plan for labor costs to increase 3.5% per year. And in fact, they increased 6%. Well, that's good for people to get good salaries and benefits. We're totally for that, but it's a lot higher than what we were told to plan for.
And the third reason?
And the third reason is that we got an actual budget cut of $1.5 million in the legislature. So we ended up in a hole of a little under $4 million. I should say, we're not alone in this. The court system is in a hole of $19 million.
We know the judges were at the state legislature last session to complain about that.
The corrections department is in a hole of about $10 million. So the whole justice system is stressed.
We'll talk about what that means here. Let me bring some listeners into the conversation here. John Stewart is in the studio with me. Today he's a state public defender, and Lisa Kloster is with us as well. She's a public defender for Dakota County. We're talking about some of the cuts and the changes that are going to occur as of today, the first day of July. The cuts start to filter in, although they've had a hiring freeze since Christmas. And we're asking, as they remove more and more public defenders from the system, as we hear this morning, the correction system is taxed and the court system is really, really taxed, underrepresented as well, what the ripple effect of all of this morning, talking specifically about public defenders, but looking at the bigger picture as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you work in the criminal justice system, I'd be curious about your views. If you're a judge, prosecutor, attorney, defense attorney, public defenders, please share your experience with us as you listen to our conversation and tell us what you think the impact of these cuts are going to be. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. Again, if you work in the criminal justice system, if you serve as a prosecutor, a public defender, a defense attorney, a judge, like to hear your views about what these cuts that we're talking about this morning may mean and what it means that the court system is making cuts themselves because they're in a budget hole along with the corrections department as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. Again, we are also going to talk about the bigger picture here. Do these budget shortfalls in our correction system, in our judicial system, tell us something more about public attitudes about criminal justice? We'll talk about that as well. From David online here in Minneapolis, I'm studying law in Minnesota and planning on pursuing public defense after school. Is it even worth applying in Minnesota for a public defender's job? Lisa, what would you say about that? Because we know people come out of law school with a lot of debt.
Well, when I went to law school and made my decision to be a lawyer, I didn't know any lawyers. I didn't know any criminal defense attorneys. And I just knew some vague television notion that lawyers made a lot of money and drove fancy cars.
Has that turned out to be true?
And that has not been my path. I choose to do this because not because of the money. I mean, you have to realize you're not going to be paying off student loans in 10 years. You have to really want to do this because you want to help people. I think the underlying motivator for most of us is we really like to help people. It's a little bit of social work and a little bit of lawyering when you're doing criminal defense
work. Why do you say that? What do you mean about the social work?
You know, most of these people, I mean, when I look at my caseload, I can probably say 99% of my clients are in the court system because of a mental illness, because of a family trauma that has caused a depression or caused bad behavior or drinking, chemical use, drug use. They're not underlying sociopathic bad people.
Mm-hmm.
That is a pretty small percentage of people. And there are things that they need help with. There are things that can change them and keep them out of the criminal system. And that's just the vast majority of the people. So there's always an issue of trying to get them back into the place where they can not be in the criminal system, not come back to the court system. I have enough work. I don't want to see these people again. Get yourself together. Get sober. Whatever you need to do, get working and go on with your life.
John, do you think there's a misperception about who the people are who use the services of the public defenders in this state? I wonder if a lot of people believe there are people that are in the system over and over again. You're never going to change them, no matter how many second chances that you give them, and the taxpayers are spending a lot of money to represent these people in court. Do you think a lot of people believe that?
Yes. I think it's a combination of the way crime is pictured in the media and the way crime has been an issue in political contests in the country for the last 20 years or so. Most of these people, as Lisa says, are an ordinary person that was under stress, drank too much, had a drug problem, snapped out, did something that was not right, maybe was a very poor decision. And in addition, we get a fair amount of people come in that actually didn't do it. You know, if you look around the country, you see these newspaper pictures of these unspeakably sad-looking guys that have been in prison for 20 years, and then they get cleared by DNA. It turned out that they didn't do it. Part of our job as public defenders in Minnesota is to try to not have that happen here.
I mean, what's the percentage, though? I think you'd have a tough time making an argument to the average person that the majority of the people that you're in court representing didn't do it?
When I was trying cases, I used to win about 30% of the cases.
What does that tell us?
Well, that tells us that
you're a good lawyer, or they didn't do it.
I don't think it was that I was such a good lawyer, but the eyewitnesses make mistakes. They say, yeah, that's him, but it's really not him. Police officers make mistakes. The law enforcement system is under a tremendous amount of stress. There aren't always the resources to do the lab tests and so on that might clear somebody. So I would say it would be a mistake to think that all of our clients are guilty, first of all. And secondly, of the people that did do something wrong, the majority of them have these kinds of problems that Lisa's been talking about. Mm-hmm. And there are some solutions that if we put the resources into it through drug treatment, the drug courts, for instance, have been very successful in Minnesota. Sadly, that's one of the things that public defenders are going to have to step back from because they're so labor-intensive. Drug courts are working great, but they're very labor-intensive, and we just don't have the staff to be staffing them all the time.
Let me take some calls here. 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000. Listening online to us, work in the criminal justice system, have a perspective on this. We'd like to hear from you online as well, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. By the way, we mentioned that Bob Collins went out with Lisa Kloster yesterday to spend some time in the courts with her, and you can find his piece that he wrote about it, a link to that on our mid-morning page at NPR.org. He is live blogging during the show, so go to NewsCut if you want to get in on this conversation with Bob. To Brenda in Apple Valley. Hi, Brenda. You're on mid-morning.
Hi. I hold the Pawlenty administration responsible for the situation in Minnesota's economy. Pawlenty has lurched from one budget crisis to another in his 6 years and has, with his no new taxes and a lean government, here's where we are with essential government services not being provided to people who qualify for them. Mm-hmm. And I also work with public defenders in a very different setting, not the adult criminal setting, and I find their work to be extremely valuable to the people that I work with who don't understand the court system, and we work collaboratively. Like the public defender said, she's part social worker, and that's my experience too. And so I think that the state needs to find the money, whether it's new taxes, new revenue streams, but they need to find the money to make sure our court system is doing what the Constitution says it's supposed to be doing.
Brenda, good to have your call. John, is the Pawlenty administration to blame for this?
Well, in my job, I don't do tax policy. I think the Pawlenty administration has done the best they can with the revenues that are available. Everybody can see that the country and the state are in an economic downturn, and a lot of businesses and public organizations can't do everything that they used to do. On the other hand, we're in kind of a unique position because public defenders get more work when the economy turns down. There's mm-hmm. more people that can't afford to hire a private lawyer. And there's also an uptick in property crimes. There's an uptick in domestic violence crimes. There's an uptick in unhappy people medicating themselves with drugs and alcohol. So the courts and public defenders particularly get more work when the economy isn't doing so hot. So Lisa, it's unfortunate, but I don't have anybody to blame.
Lisa, I want to follow up on something that John just said. When the economy is tough, it's harder for people to afford their own lawyers. Can you say this morning, and nothing against the quality of your legal mind and your legal representation, but can you say that given the caseload and given what you're juggling and dealing with, that you provide a client with the same high quality of legal representation that you'd get if you went out there and hired a lawyer and paid them $125 an hour?
You know, I've done private work. I'm going back now doing part-time so that I can pick up some private clients as well right now. And so I have that experience. And when you have a private client and you go down to the courthouse with one client on one calendar, that client is getting all of your attention. They're having every question is answered. You're spending a lot of time with that person. You're probably talking to their family members. I think that the legal end of it in the public defender realm is different. The hand-holding, talking, information-providing stuff is what gets cut out. But we're still reading all the files, making all the legal arguments, filing the motions, and when you're under the time crunch, I think what happens to the public defenders is that they have to cut out, I can't talk to you for 3 hours on the day before our court date.
Right.
I will talk to you tomorrow when we get there. Because I need to spend those 3 hours prepping your case, and I have a really great argument, but I need to get it ready.
So is the answer yes, the private client probably benefits?
I think they benefit from the experience. I think it is and you're going to hear this when you talk to clients, you know, my public defender doesn't know who I am and they're running around and, you know, I know who they are and I know their files and I know what's going on, but I'm not going to be able to have the communication and the connection with that person. And that is a problem because I want to have trust with this person. I want them to be honest with me. I'm going to be able to help them the most when they're working with me. But that's the part that's got to cut out because I can't say, well, I don't have time to read the file.
Right.
Or I don't have time to challenge that illegal stop of the vehicle. So if I have to cut something, I'm going to have to cut that part of it out. And I don't like that personally. I think for me, because I like helping people, I like working with people. That's my favorite part is working with my clients. But that's what's going to have to cut. Every time as the caseloads go up, there's going to be less and less communication, explanation, all of that stuff is just going to get narrowed out.
Let me go to the phones here to Eric in Rochester. Hi, Eric. Thanks for waiting. Hi. Comment for us.
Yeah, I'm just calling in support of drug courts. I mean, it seems to me that from an efficiency standpoint, that if drug courts are working and if they are one of the bright spots in our judicial system for some of these clients, that it would just make sense to continue public defender involvement in post-adjudication drug courts, the majority of which my understanding is we have here in Minnesota, that ultimately that would reduce the public defender's caseload for probation violations, et cetera. And I just wanted to hear okay. Mr. Stewart's comment.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for the call. What's going to happen with public defenders and drug courts?
Mostly public defenders are not going to be staffing the drug courts. I agree with Eric that ultimately it would be better if the public defenders could be there. But the key word is ultimately. The drug courts are going to save Minnesota a lot of money in the long run. And they're going to produce a lot of people who are functioning as productive people in a community rather than prisoners in the long run. But in the short run, it takes time. And we can't operate on a basis that we'll give you 10 public defenders today in order to save 10 prison beds 2 years from now, because we have the crunch right now. So it's sad that we're not able to invest in the things that ultimately would make a huge difference.
Are there other specialty courts that public defenders have got to step out of besides the drug courts?
Well, you know, there are juvenile court cases involving child protection and child welfare, and public defenders have been representing parents in those cases. But by law, the counties are supposed to be paying for the representation of parents. So effective a week from today, we're going to stop representing parents. Other than in Hennepin County, we're going to stop representing parents in these child protection cases.
So the parents will have no legal representation unless they can afford to go hire a lawyer?
No, the parents will have legal representation provided by the counties. Public defense is a state function, and we have our state budget. But there are other forms of law that the counties pay for. Okay. For instance, mental illness commitment defense is for counties. Family court has got some functions that counties pay for the lawyers. And now, like family court, the counties are going to need to step up to the plate and pay for parents' lawyers for CHIPS cases. This is a tough thing because we know the counties are short of cash too, but legally it's their job to do it.
Let me take a break for news. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Our guests this hour, Lisa Kloster, a public defender for Dakota County, and John Stewart with us, a state public defender. We're talking about some of the cuts that will begin to take place, really have already taken place as a hiring freeze in place since Christmas, but this month begins more cuts, and at the end of it all, we're hearing 72 public defenders eliminated for now from the system, asking about what the implications of that are for the criminal justice system, and asking you, if you work in the system, if you're a prosecutor, you're a judge, you work in some other capacity in the system, your views, your perspectives on what's happening in the criminal justice system as not just public defenders, but other parts of it absorb these budget cuts. 800-242-2828. We've got full phone lines here. You can get in online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. By the way, Bob Collins out with Lisa Kloster yesterday to get a look at what a typical day in the life of a public defender is like. You can find that piece on a link at the mid-morning page, and he's also live blogging this morning. So go to the News Cut blog and join into the conversation. Back in just a moment to the newsroom and Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Gary, the International Energy Agency says the amount of oil hitting the market over the next 5 years will be less than what is first predicted, but still enough to meet demand by a thin margin. The head of the IEA says the world is in the grip of an oil shock. Oil prices are near $143 a barrel today amid concerns about a potential conflict between Israel and Iran and a weakening dollar. One analyst says he does not see much that would stand in the way of $150 a barrel in the weeks ahead. Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey says he's learned shoddy contracting work may have caused 13 Americans to be electrocuted in Iraq since 2003. Houston-based KBR has been ordered to inspect all the facilities it maintains for electrical safety hazards after two soldiers were electrocuted while taking showers. An Illinois man is under arrest after the FBI says he ordered a deadly toxin from a New Jersey chemical company. Authorities say Edward Bochner tried to buy an unusually large amount of tetrodotoxin by claiming he was a doctor. The toxin is found in puffer fish. A 20-year-old man has been charged with first-degree criminal sexual conduct after authorities say he and several other men forced a woman into a car in St. Paul and assaulted her in a garage. Police say the 22-year-old woman, who reported the incident, was 6 months pregnant. Lord Kendrick of St. Paul is being held in the Ramsey County Jail. A Burnsville jewelry dealer is the keeper of a 22-pound solid gold coin commemorating the 2008 Olympic Games, which will be held in Beijing. The coin is the only one of its kind in the country and comes with a $1 million price tag. Only 29 commemorative gold coins have been issued by the China Mint. Weather forecast today calls for mostly sunny skies around the state. Slight chance of thunderstorms in the far north this afternoon. Highs today, mid-80s to low 90s. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's 73, and the skies are mostly sunny. It's 9:35. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Hi, Gary Eichten here, inviting you to join us for midday on Independence Day. We'll hear a soldier's audio letters from the Vietnam War.
You know, you get nervous, you know, after being shot at a lot. And then some dog would run out from a village or either that or a rabbit or even a little twig would fall and make a little noise, you know. Everyone would just open up with machine guns and then, wow.
The Vietnam Letters, July 4th at noon on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Today's programming is sponsored in part by Suzanne Magdalene and Charles Betts in celebration of the marriage and parenthood of Brad Murray and Laura Moore. We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we are talking with a guest of ours who has been on the show a number of times with us, Leroy Sievers. You may hear his commentaries on Morning Edition. We've talked with him throughout the couple of years that he's been blogging about his cancer. He's a former executive producer of Nightline. So we've talked about his career in journalism, his decision that he wanted to be very transparent about his battle with cancer, some of the challenges that that transparency has brought with it, and now what's happening with his treatment. He recently aired a commentary on Morning Edition about the fact that he went in for some routine scans, expected some optimistic news, and the news was rather troubling. So we'll talk with Leroy Sievers at 10 o'clock. I hope you're with us for that. Back to our conversation this hour, talking about cuts in the public defender's system and the ripple effect that that may have on the court system overall. And I'm going to go to the phones here so we can get to some of these calls to Anne in St. Paul. Hi, Anne. You're on Mid-Morning. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. My question is for John Stewart. He's the chief public defender for the entire state.
Right.
And I'd like to know what his plan of action is under his watch. You know, he's lost ground now, 72 lawyers. I'm a former public defender, and I'm proud to say it's a great system, and it provides great representation. So I'd like to see that continue, and I'm wondering what he's planning on doing.
What's the plan? All right.
The State Board of Public Defense met all afternoon on June 5th to consider a lot of options. And coming out of that meeting, here's what the plan is. First of all, we know that we're losing 15% of the lawyers around the state, which is a lot, and it's terrible, and it's particularly terrible for the folks that are laid off. But here's the response. We're going to stop doing cases that aren't required by the Constitution or aren't required by state statute. So first of all, that's the parents in the child protection cases. Secondly, we're going to pull back from staffing the drug courts where the person has already been found guilty. They have a right to a lawyer if they violate their conditions and or if they're accused of violating their conditions, then we'll come back in. But we're not going to be there for the staffings and the hearings week after week. Thirdly, we're going to prioritize excellent representation of people in criminal cases who are in custody. The people that are in jail have to be taken care of first because they've already lost their freedom by being in jail. To accomplish this, it may be necessary that some of the cases of people who are not in custody will have to be delayed. Minnesota has a policy that the court system is taking a second look at of moving the cases through the system very fast. For the person that's in custody, that's important. But for the person who is living at home and has a charge of shoplifting or some such, they may face some delay. Then in January, we will be back in the state legislature and talking with the governor and making our case to get the money back and to resume being fully staffed.
John,
we believe in the long run, we're going to get back up to full strength.
I mean, you know what's happening with the economy, and 2009 at the state capitol is already looking like it could be quite difficult. What if this is ground that you've lost for good?
Well, we're actually a rather small item in the state budget, but it's an item that is uniquely important because of the Constitution and because of our role in keeping the court system functioning. And we think that even today, as people are listening to your show, they're thinking, you know, that's right. We've got to get these folks back up to full strength. I've heard that from so many people around the state. I've been driving around the state meeting with people for a month, and everybody says this has to be taken care of. So I'm optimistic that despite the gloomy clouds in the big picture, I think people will look at us and say this is necessary.
Lisa, online here from John Paul in Minneapolis, what's the best statistic to describe the overload of work? Is it the ratio of PDs to cases, to hearings, to crimes, to courts?
That's a complicated question. You know, the caseloads themselves are high, but the problem is kind of the daily activity that you have to take care of. In my position, trying to take care of what needs to be done probably that week or maybe tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
and getting things prepared and dealing with that amount of volume, that's kind of my challenge. And as the caseloads, well, already, you know, the crimes have been increasing, the charges have been increasing, we've got more serious things that we're dealing with, we have more people in custody, so all of that's already happening. And then to look at losing attorneys, so I'm going to be getting their caseloads, mm-hmm. some of those files will come back. And then the other problem that I see filtering down by the time John's in doing some lobbying for us for money, by that point, those people are not in the rotation to pick up the new cases as well. So that means I'm picking up more cases and I'm in court covering those pickup calendars more often.
Right.
So there's less time that I'm actually doing my paperwork too.
Is the obvious answer more plea bargaining, less time in court, less time going through potential trials, cutting deals?
You know, I hope that I get nervous when people say things like that. We'll just, you know, deal these out. Because there are times when maybe some of them need to be dealt out. But it's not just me that's making that decision. I can look at the case and I can say, this is a bad case. This person is going to be convicted. But the prosecutor wants them to go to prison. And they shouldn't be going to prison. This person should not be in prison. But if the prosecutor on the other side doesn't have the same view that I have, I'm going to be trying that case. And I have to have a judge that agrees. If I get the prosecutor to agree, the judge has to say, I agree, this person shouldn't go to prison. So I'm not the only one that can make a deal on a case, and I'm not the only one who has the perception of this. And so we do have to work as a team on some of those cases. We have to be able to work together to resolve some of the cases, but the ones that have to be tried, the ones that have the illegal stops or illegal searches, we have to put those into the court system. We have to try those things. And there's no way to deal out some of that stuff. If there's an unconstitutional stop, there's no way to deal that.
Okay. Let me go to the phones here to John Lesh. Representative Lesh, good to have you on the line.
Hello.
What'd you want to tell us?
Well, I have a question for John Stewart, and it's ironic that that you're on today, and I'm listening to you, and I had a friend just inform me, so I just started listening. But, John, I was in court last Thursday, and you got some law clerks down at arraignment representing clients who clearly do not qualify for public defenders. And these are people who on paper do not qualify, and they want to stand up for them, think it's going to make it smoother. I also know that there's serious questions about the process, about the screening process. Over 70% of criminal defendants statewide, according to your office, qualify for public defense services. Free lawyers paid for by both sides, by the taxpayers. There's some serious concerns about this, and I know oftentimes you ask public defenders about this and they blame the judges appoint. But I think there's responsibility on both sides here to ensure that only the truly indigent, according to your mission, are getting represented with free services paid for by taxpayers. How do you plan on addressing that?
Representative, I need some clarification on this. You're saying you were in court and there were clients there that were being represented by public defenders who shouldn't have been?
That's correct. In Ramsey County, these people did not qualify on paper for free legal defense
services. Then why are they getting free legal defense services?
Because judges say it's smoother to just have them taken care of at arraignment, represented by free public defenders, and put them into the system, having plead guilty as a pro se client, and then get more court dates.
John, is that true?
I think Representative Lesh is completely right that we could work on the screening that the courts do. When Lisa goes to court, nobody asks her to decide, are these folks eligible? Instead, she gets a list of people that have been screened by the court, and the court says, Lisa, you're appointed for these 8 folks. So it's not our function to do it. It's not uniform around the state. We have improved the standards for it several times over the years, working with the Criminal Rules of Procedure Committee. Nevertheless, the screening process is often determined by county funding, and so you have a position of, will the county hire an eligibility screener with its money in order to save the state money on public defenders?
Representative Lesch, is that the answer to this?
Well, we have probation doing the screening right now. Partially, I think it's the answer. However, the people who are in the best positions, despite the fact that the judges are appointing these people, the folks who are in the best positions to determine whether or not an individual is truly indigent and truly qualifies is their attorney, is the public defender. And oftentimes the public defender says, nope, it's just my job to vigorously defend my client. And we see a lot of people sneaking through who shouldn't be.
So maybe the public defender, ought to be standing up in court and saying, you know what, this person should not be on my case. Let me ask Lisa about this. Does that happen?
It does happen. And this comes around a lot, because we may pick up someone in the jail who on paper has lost their job, is charged with a serious crime, would qualify, but I'm successful in getting them out. Maybe they get another job, they start working, and at maybe the next court appearance, they don't qualify. It is very, very difficult to put this on the public defender that's standing in the courtroom. I've got 7 clients. I'm trying to make them all happy. I'm trying to make them trust me. I'm trying to get a relationship with these people. And I stand up in front of the judge and I say, oh, judge, I don't want this client anymore. I don't think he qualifies. Will you ask him about this? Which, one thing, the judge may say, I'm going to keep you on the case. That's not a good relationship builder. And second of all, I have a whole courtroom full of people that are watching me do this. And so you're right, in theory it sounds great. I probably know the most about what's going on. But in the practical application of being in that courtroom, it is very, very difficult.
Representative, what about that?
Well, yes, I understand it puts a person in a unique position as a public defender. But we recall that when we're looking at 70% of the criminal defendant caseload in the state of Minnesota getting free attorneys because we're not adequately screening, that is a serious hit to the state's budget, and it will impact a public defender caseload. So I think the public defenders need to look at this individually, maybe not on an individual basis, but as a matter of policy, I think it needs to be considered.
Let me ask you something before you go. You heard John Stewart perhaps saying that he was going to be over at the state legislature in January lobbying to return some of this money to the system that they've lost over this last year. What kind of an attitude do you think there will be at the Capitol about that, given what we already know is going on with the economy and potential budget shortfalls in 2009?
There has always been, I think, a generally good and favorable attitude towards funding of the public defenders at the state Capitol. We have seen them, including prosecutors like myself, have seen them having to scramble around between courtrooms and bog down court calendars because they're understaffed. The issue is that the governor has been unwilling to adequately invest in our state infrastructure and our public defense system, our court system. And so that's been the problem. If we can get the governor to relent and say, Governor, you need to recognize the importance of a good public defense system, that will make a difference.
Well, but the governor's also dealing with a lot of budget problems himself, right?
Sure. I mean,
it isn't that he's really picking and choosing enemies here. He's trying to balance out shortfalls all the way around, right?
Well, he balances out shortfalls by just essentially saying, you know, no new taxes. And we see the impact on the state investment. So, yes, that's true, but it has affected the court system disproportionately, including public defenders. And I think many people on the committees think that's a travesty and would like to address it next session.
All right. Good to have your call, and I'm glad somebody called you to listen in. Thanks.
Thank you
very much. Online here from Chris in Eagan says, I'm a South Dakota lawyer, and I can see that the delays due to lack of defense attorneys will stall and kill some cases. This will increase appeals. John, is that another one of the ripple effects of this?
Well, people do have a right to a speedy trial. And there will be appeals about the denial of a speedy trial. There's no doubt about that. But as I say, the Board of Public Defense has prioritized, and we're going to be providing excellent representation, starting with people who are in custody. So my hope is that by no longer doing the non-mandated services of child protection parents and pulling back some from the drug courts and delaying some of the out-of-custody cases, we will be able to get speedy trials for the people that make speedy trial demands.
Lisa, you described the public defender system as the underdog of the criminal justice system. And I wonder if what we're seeing here, besides just the economic reality, is maybe an attitude on the part of taxpayers and constituents that when money is tight, maybe this just isn't the place that people want to invest their money. You see pushback on that about prisons, even as corrections officials come to the state legislature and say, we've got to build more prisons. There's reluctance that, you know, to put short dollars, tight money, into those kinds of things. Does it tell us anything about general attitudes, do you think?
I think it does. I know it's not favorable to put money into the criminals. And I've had the individual, just as John has, I've had these individual conversations with people about what it means to protect our Constitution and why we should fund this. And I give them my food shelf analogy that, you know, when times are tough, the demand is higher for the food shelf, but then there's less people that are going to be able to put into the food shelf, and I understand that. But you have to realize that's what's happening, and you got to work a little harder to make sure that that still sustains itself. And that's the same with our system. And once I get people talking about it and they think about it and they realize what the whole process is, such as it's going to cost more to confine people, it's going to cost more to do the appellate part of this, it's going to cost more for other things down the line. If we don't address this, if we can't go to specialty court and we can't, which we know everybody in the system knows is successful, and we can't address some of these issues, these people will come back and be repeat offenders. We're going to have more work. So the cost issue, it doesn't go away. It comes somewhere else. So funding it and getting the food shelf pantry full at mm-hmm. the front end, there's a benefit to that, and that's what you're doing. And you really have to be able to realize, you know, this is a constitutional issue. This is, you have the right to have an attorney, and you might not think you need my help today, but your son might or your neighbor might, and I'm there working and I'm ready to help you. And I'm supporting this system. And the beliefs that I think Minnesota citizens have about how important it is to provide this service, when I have those conversations with people, their attitudes change.
Then they get it.
They get it.
Online here, John, and I'm glad this was brought up online. I meant to get to this from Susan. How are victims' rights affected by the large caseload? Are as yet nonviolent offenders pushed through the system? First to the victims. Rights. What's the fallout from this for victims of crimes?
I think that people who are victims of crimes that are allegedly done by people who aren't in custody are going to find themselves waiting longer to get their day in court. That's just the sad reality of it, because we have to prioritize and we're going to take the cases of people in jail first. So there will be some delays. But, you know, a lot of those victims are not the individual that you might be thinking about, but it might be Target stores. We get hundreds of cases of retail shoplifting, and there's going to be some delays there. And your Walmart, your Target may not get restitution as quick as they would have if the court system were staffed up to par.
But let me ask you this. If the whole system slows down because of this, for the individual crime victim, isn't there also a risk that the longer it takes to get this case through the system, the harder it is to prove out the case? Witnesses go away or memories fade? Or I mean, is that something else that victims of crimes would be aware of?
I think that's true. Minnesota is still going to be a very fast-moving court system compared to a lot of other states.
Why is that?
Well, it's been a priority for the judges to follow judicial performance guidelines where the vast majority of cases have to be resolved in 90 days. Now we're hearing from the judges that they don't think they're going to be able to do that. You know, the judges had a hiring freeze for their staff, and they have over 200 positions that they've lost through a hiring freeze. So this is a system-wide problem. It's not just the public defenders are slowing things down.
And we know that the judges have been to the state capitol to make that case.
You bet.
So again, if 09 looks, it turns out to be as it looks right now, and money is tight again at the state capitol, did the judges end up getting, you know, some compensation back and the public defenders have to wait?
I think that the legislative committees realize that the court system is an ecosystem. You know, the different species that are in the court system have to be in balance. People say it's a three-legged stool. You have to have prosecutors, you have to have judges, you have to have public defenders. If you lose a leg off the stool, the thing falls over. So I trust the legislature to take care of this in a balanced manner. And I hope that it's a priority. You know, we're talking a few million dollars here, but in a state budget of over $30 billion, this could be taken care of.
Lisa, have you thought about leaving and going to do something else?
You know, actually, I recently went into part-time, and I thought I'd be able to pick up some private work on the side here and make some additional money. And basically, at this point, I'm not even pursuing any private clients just so that I can concentrate on my public defender work and try to get through this with my fingers crossed that we're going to see a change hopefully in 6 months and we're going to have some more staff back to help. So I've been doing public defender work for 13, 14 years, and my husband says I clearly must enjoy it because I never talk about leaving. But I complain a lot about it. High caseloads, but I don't talk about leaving.
You know, it's people like Lisa that give me the hope that I have that we're going to get this taken care of. That's why I'm optimistic.
Good to have you both here. Thanks very much.
Thank
you.
Appreciate
it.
Thank you.
John Stewart is state public defender in the studio with us as well as Lisa Kloster. She's a public defender for Dakota County. If you want to find out what it was like for Bob Collins to hang out with Lisa yesterday and go to some of those court appearances and meet with some of the clients, you can read about that on the NewsCut blog. You'll find a link to it on the mid-morning page at minnesotapublicradio.org. And for all of you that waited to get in on the conversation and didn't make it into the discussion, sorry about that. Bob is blogging right now. So if you'd like to go online and add your views to his blogging conversation there, we'd be happy to have him. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Leroy Sievers is with us. You hear his commentaries about his battle with cancer on Morning Edition. He's been a guest on our show a number of times, and he recently recorded a commentary that I caught that I thought, time to talk to Leroy again. He'd gone in for some routine scans, come through a big battle with cancer in his spine, and the news that he got from the routine scans was troubling. He's been blogging about it. You can read the blog at npr.org. That's npr.org, called My Cancer. We'll have a link to it on the mid-morning page as well. Coming up tomorrow at 10, I think this is going to be a lively discussion, equal parenting. Why is it something that a lot of couples say they want and yet have such a hard time actually pulling off? The studies will surprise you. And how about when it comes to housework? Men say they're doing more around the house. Men say they're doing more with childcare. But if you actually dig into the research, you find out that women are still providing 5 to 1 ratio of childcare, and they're doing double the amount of housework that men are. Why is that? Why is that? So we'll talk about that tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I'll be interested to hear your experience with that. This is Mid-Morning.